Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. This is As It Is, the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we have two stories for you, presented at a slower speed and using words that are easy to understand. The first is about an old problem for law enforcement. The United Nations is offering some solutions. Then we will talk about an upcoming visit to the U.S. by Japan's Prime Minister. Some of the issues to be discussed at this important meeting should interest you. Okay, let's get started with part one. A United Nations committee is calling on some African countries to change their laws so police can cross national borders when they are chasing terrorist suspects. Jean-Paul Laborde is the executive director of the United Nations Counter-Terrorism Committee. He says people being chased by police can often avoid capture by fleeing to another country. That is because police from one country are often not permitted to follow fleeing suspects into another country without written permission.
Of course, there is more to be done, not only by the international community, but also at the regional level, in terms of police cooperation, which is already well done among the countries of Central Africa. But it's also needed to establish a link with the other parts of Africa, especially with ECOWAS and with the countries of this region.
Mr. Laborde, along with representatives from organizations that help the UN fight terrorists, is visiting Cameroon. Mr. Laborde says they are seeking the necessary support to fight terrorism within the limits of the law. Mr. Laborde and the groups are urging countries in West and Central Africa to cooperate. Some of those countries are battling with the terrorist group Boko Haram, which has been fighting for 6 years to put in place a strict form of Sharia law across northern Nigeria. In recent years, the group has been attacking areas of Cameroon and Chad. This month, Boko Haram said it would join with the Middle East-based terrorist group called Islamic State. Earlier this year, Nigeria, Niger, Chad, Benin, and Cameroon agreed to create a regional force of more than 8,000 troops to fight Boko Haram. The troops have started cross-border military operations. You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is making plans for a state visit to the United States. Mr. Abe will travel to Washington next month for talks with President Barack Obama. The two leaders are expected to discuss a number of issues, including the security alliance between their countries. Bob Doty looks at a change in Japan's constitution and foreign security policy and how it relates to the alliance.
Shinzo Abe was re-elected as Prime Minister of Japan in 2012. Since then, Mr. Abe has shown a willingness to create a more aggressive security policy for his country. He wants Japan to be a more active partner in its security relations with the United States. He also wants more Japanese involvement in efforts to settle conflicts in Asia and the Pacific. One reason for a more active policy has been Japan's recent decision to reconsider part of its constitution, known as Article 9. The article bars the country from going to war or having a military. Tetsuo Kotani works for the Japan Institute of International Affairs. He says the country took a big step when it reinterpreted Article 9, looking at the measure in a different way.
Last year, the Japanese government made a cabinet decision to reinterpret Article 9 so that Japan can exercise so-called collective self-defense, which means Japan can provide protection for other countries' militaries when we are conducting combined operations. So in that sense, we already reinterpreted our Article 9, and now we are reviewing our security legislation to reflect this cabinet decision.
Observers believe that Mr. Abe has been pushing for the change for a number of reasons. Some say one is Mr. Abe's personality. Scott Harold is with the RAND Corporation Research Group.
In part, it's because Abe fundamentally believes that it's his mission as prime minister, and he's been given a second chance to do it after resigning in disgrace in 2007. He's been given a second bite at the apple, and this time around he's determined to make sure that Japan reaches a number of important national security goals that will help ensure its survival as a nation.
At the same time, Japan's relations with its neighbors are involved. Shihoko Gato is an expert on Northeast Asia for the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. She says the biggest regional influence is China.
China's growing military presence, its military budget alone is going up by double digits, and also the territorial disputes. China has these with a number of Asian countries, but in the East China Sea, it's with Japan over what Japan calls the Senkaku Islands. There's also the North Korea threat that continues to this day.
Shihoko Gato adds that Mr. Abe's move to reinterpret the meaning of Article 9 also had to do with the United States. She says President Obama has talked about America's need to rebalance to Asia. But she notes the U.S. government has limits on how much it can spend. She says the Obama administration is also concerned about the Middle East and the situation in Russia. Observers believe the Japanese decision was at least partly based on Japan's need to become more involved in defense cooperation with the U.S. Any opening in security legislation is welcome. Those are the words of Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Poole, a U.S. Defense Department spokesman. The Islamic State militant group executed two Japanese citizens earlier this year. With that and Mr. Abe's visit next month, observers believe the security alliance will be an important part of the discussions. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the Voice of America. If you are listening to this program on the radio, we are happy to have you with us. But you are missing out on a great opportunity to learn even more about American English and the world. We urge you to find the Learning English website on your computer. You will find many more stories than we have time for in the radio broadcast. Download the computer audio as a podcast and save it. Also, print the stories, then go back and listen to the podcast as you read along. You might even try saying some of the words and sentences you heard us say. The best way to learn is to start slowly, saying only one or two sentences. Then try more. Practice every day, and soon you'll be speaking English the American way.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The Chinese economy is growing at its lowest rate in almost 25 years. Yet the Asian Development Bank appears hopeful about Asia's developing economies in the months to come. The ADB, based in the Philippines, released its outlook report this week. It says economic gains in India and Southeast Asia, America's economic recovery, and low oil prices will help offset a moderating economy in China. In other words, all three factors could serve as a counterbalance to China's slowing growth. The bank's chief economist, Shang Jinhui, says the outlook report predicts strong growth over the next 2 years.
Developing Asia's growth is holding steady, forecast to be 6.3% for this year and next year, and that's a consequence of India and Indonesia doing better than their recent past, offsetting the moderation of growth rates in PRC.
The ADB predicted that Thailand's economy was set to improve in the months to come. The report said its growth would lead to better economic conditions across Southeast Asia. Several countries across Asia, including India and Indonesia, have cut fuel subsidies because of lower fuel prices. The cuts have improved budget and fiscal expectations, opening the way for more government spending on social services. China's economy is expected to slow to a yearly growth rate of 7%. One reason for this is slower growth in the value of land and other investments. Mr. Wei said moderating growth is a result of rising labor costs, a changing population, and a rise in the value of China's currency, the renminbi. The report says Southeast Asian economies will expand at a more than 5% rate in 2016. The bank's outlook for Pacific economies is also positive. But in Central Asia, economic growth has already slowed because of lower oil prices. The recession in Russia has affected Central Asian economies. The ADB warned that economic growth in Central Asia will slump further. The ADB also warned of several risk factors, including policy missteps during China's economic moderation. Other factors are a slowing of India's economic reforms and questions arising from the debt crisis in Greece. Another financial consideration is the possibility that the U.S. Central Bank will raise interest rates. The bank said any rate increase would pull investment money away from Asia and unsettle financial markets there. The bank said an increase in oil prices because of geopolitical tensions would hurt earlier gains from lower fuel costs. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. A new leader stood before the American people on March 4, 1913. He was Woodrow Wilson, the 28th President of the United States. Wilson belonged to the Democratic Party. He was progressive in his belief that government should take an active part in efforts for social reforms. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe begin the story of Wilson's presidency.
Woodrow Wilson had spent most of his life at Princeton University. First, he was a professor. Then, he was university president. Next, Wilson was elected governor of the state of New Jersey. His early success as governor made him a leading candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1912. Wilson traveled widely around the country during the campaign. He made speeches to many groups. He tried to make himself and his ideas known to as many Americans as possible.
Wilson called his program the New Freedom. One of his campaign promises was to fight for better conditions for America's small business owners. Such proposals helped him win the Democratic nomination for president. Then he defeated President William Howard Taft and former President Theodore Roosevelt in the election. Woodrow Wilson, the former president of a university, had become the president of a nation. The largest crowd in Washington, D.C.'s history welcomed Wilson outside the Capitol building on the day of his inauguration. He called on the American people to join him in making the country a better place. "Our duty," Wilson said, "is to correct the evil without hurting the good. I call all honest men, all patriotic, all forward-looking men to my side."
Wilson wasted no time. He immediately called a special session of Congress to act on Democratic campaign promises to reduce import taxes or tariffs. Wilson felt strongly about the need to reform these taxes. He broke tradition by leaving the White House to appear before Congress in person to appeal for his tariff proposals. Many members of Congress opposed Wilson's plans. But the new president used the results of a Senate investigation to win the fight. The investigation showed that a number of senators owned companies that depended on high tariffs for their profits. The votes of these senators were influenced by their property holdings. Public knowledge of the situation forced many of them to give up their holdings and stop resisting tariff reform. Congress finally approved Wilson's proposals.
Lower tariffs reduced the amount of money taken in by the federal government. So the Senate also approved a tax on income, or earnings. A constitutional amendment had been passed earlier to permit such a tax. President Wilson and the Democratic Party were pleased with the new tariff and income tax bills. But they were far from finished. Next, they turned their efforts to reform of the banking industry. For several years, many people had recognized the need for changes in the banking system. The old system of uncontrolled private banks had developed years earlier, before the United States became a major industrial nation. Many people agreed that a more modern system was needed, but they could not agree on details.
President Wilson said control of the nation's wealth was held by too few men. He noted a report that said just two men controlled 10% of the total wealth of the United States. Wilson said the nation needed a money supply that could be increased or reduced when necessary to correct economic conditions. He said a method was needed to let banks help each other during economic emergencies. And, he said, laws were needed to prevent a few wealthy men from using the economic resources of the country for their own purposes. Finally, Wilson said the control of this system of banking must be public, not private. It must belong to the government itself.
Wilson called his proposal for a central bank the Federal Reserve System. Under the plan, the nation would be divided into 12 areas. Each area would have its own Federal Reserve Bank. These area banks would not do business with the public. They would serve only as bankers' banks. And they would issue a new form of money supported by the federal government. Most important, the leaders of the new system would be chosen by the government, not by private business.
Bankers, business leaders, and their representatives in Congress sharply criticized President Wilson's proposals. They said government control of the banking system was socialism, not capitalism. But Wilson refused to change his proposals, and he helped to lead the fight to make them law. Finally, Congress agreed. It did not take long for bankers to discover that the new system was much better than the old one. Today, the Federal Reserve System is one of the most important institutions in the United States.
For Woodrow Wilson, the fight over the banking system was yet another political success. He had won major reforms in the nation's tariffs, taxes, and banking systems. Now, he told Congress, that new legislation was needed to control the power of monopolies and trusts. These were the giant companies and business alliances that controlled complete industries. Wilson proposed a new antitrust law to control the actions of large companies. His supporters in Congress wrote a bill that listed a number of business activities that no longer would be permitted. For example, no longer could a company set prices that would reduce competition or create a monopoly. No longer could corporations buy stocks of competing companies. No longer could they demand that a store refuse to sell competing products. The new bill also protected labor unions from being charged with antitrust violations. It gave unions more power to organize and protect workers.
At President Wilson's request, Congress also prepared a law that set up a government agency called the Federal Trade Commission. The commission was given the job of investigating wrongdoing in business. It had the power to force companies to obey the new antitrust laws and other rules. Both the antitrust law and the Federal Trade Commission help protect small business owners from the power of business giants. Once again, the proposals caused fierce debate. But once again, Congress finally voted to give Wilson most of what he wanted.
The early months of Wilson's term were one of the most successful times in the history of any president. The new president had won the election by promising major reforms in the economic life of the country, and he had kept that promise. The reforms were not only a victory for Woodrow Wilson, they also changed the face of American business and economics for many years to come. The income tax, for example, grew to become the federal government's main source of money.
Woodrow Wilson had taught history in the days when he was a professor at Princeton University. He knew his actions as president could influence the country for a long time. But as a historian, he also knew his own term in the White House could be changed by unexpected events. That is just what happened. Wilson campaigned for president mainly on national issues, but he soon was forced to spend more and more time on international issues. His first big problem was across the United States southern border in Mexico. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.